guiltiness, as Bob Marley says it. And that's the great Bob Marley saying it. This is Lead Stories. I'm Patrice Lead. It is Friday, July 19th, and I'm going to be talking today about George Zimmerman's natural rights versus Trayvon Martin's civil rights. Several months ago, you may recall, we had this discussion about natural rights and civil rights. And it hasn't changed much since Judge Taney, Roger B. Taney, in the famous Dred Scott decision, ruled essentially, in fact, I'm going to read you an excerpt of his ruling. It is difficult at this day to realize the state of public opinion in regard to that unfortunate race which prevailed in the civilized and enlightened portions of the world at the time of the Declaration of Independence. And when the Constitution of the United States was framed and adopted, but the public history of every European nation displays it in a manner too plain to be mistaken. They had for more than a century before been regarded as beings of an inferior order and altogether unfit to associate with the white race, either in social or political relations, and so far unfit that they had no rights which the white man was bound to respect. That was Justice Roger B. Taney writing what is now considered to be a dreadful decision in the ruling of the case Dred Scott versus Sanford. And I thought about Sanford because, of course, the location of our focus these past few days has been the city of Sanford, Florida. Sanford, in the Dred Scott case, is spelled with a D. It was misspelled because the original person's name was actually S-A-N-F-O-R-D. Dred Scott was purchased as a slave and stayed in a free state, it should have been called, you could call it a free state, at the time, where slavery was prohibited. His, I don't even like using the word, his owner was a surgeon in the army, moved around quite a bit. And finally, at this point, it occurred to Dred Scott when he was in Illinois, which at the time forbade slavery. He thought that it would have been a great time to appeal for his freedom. By that time, the army surgeon who had purchased him had died, and as a property, as a piece of property, which slaves were, he was transferred to the ownership of the surgeon's sister. And she decided, well, okay, I'll keep you. Except that Dred Scott by then had been married, had children, and wanted to be free. And she refused to set him free. And so he petitioned the court, saying that he is, in fact, in a state that prohibits slavery, and therefore he's entitled to be free. Not only that, there was a matter of quite a bit of money that was not paid to him for his labor, and Miss Sanford also did not want to pay him that. So the case went to court, and ultimately it landed in Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court. And Judge Taney did say that Dred Scott belonged to an inferior race. And as a member of that inferior race, had no rights that the white man need respect. It's a seminal case, although it's not discussed a lot. But I will tell you, as many observers of the court would, that this very case is the starting point not only for social movements in the United States and how people construe where black folks belong in society and how they ought to be treated in society. This is the one case, if you don't understand anything else, this is the case to understand, the Dred Scott decision. Because the ruling, in effect, said blacks could not and should not be citizens of the United States, and they should have no rights at all that are shared by citizens of the United States. A slave is not a citizen. And we are here now in the year 2013 discussing laughably the idea of a post-racial society. Some of us are really fooled into thinking that we are in a post-racial society, when in fact the standing principles of the ruling in the Dred Scott decision remain quite intact and pervasive. And there we have essentially the definition and the differentiation between natural rights and civil rights. At that time, blacks had no rights, but their owners had natural rights. And it would take a long struggle, even after the passage of the 13th and 14th and 15th Amendments, it would take a long time, this question about how do we treat black people in the United States? What rights are they entitled to? I did say that what is instructive about the case of Zimmerman is that the system prevailed. And this is very important to understand. Yes, people were saying, well, it's a racial issue. Why is it a racial issue? Well, you have Zimmerman, he's Latino, and you have Trayvon Martin, he's African American. It's a racial thing, isn't it? Well, yes and no. Because very early on, George Zimmerman was given special dispensation. He was white by proxy, as I said. He was given honorary status. Why? Because he was the agent of a special kind of treatment that is to be accorded to African Americans. And that is to regard them as if they have no rights. The system spotted that. And so they identified Zimmerman, not only because his father was a former magistrate and his mother worked in the court system and so forth. These things are also important, but the most important part of it is they recognized an agent of the conditioning that must win, that must prevail. And that is that George Zimmerman put, I hate to put it crudely, but this is the interpretation of it, he put Trayvon Martin in his place. He killed him, yes, but then Trayvon Martin deserved to be killed. He did not understand that when you come up against the system, the power, you are to submit to it. And you literally take your life in your hands if you should continue to press for your so-called rights. You have no rights. George Zimmerman understood that the minute he opened his car door. He knew that that young man had no rights. He had all the power. He had all the rights. He had been thoroughly inculcated with the values of Sanford. And by the way, Sanford does not have a wonderful history. In the 1940s, there was an issue in Sanford surrounding Jackie Robinson. Man just wanted to train, to just a train in Sanford. And before you know it, there was a huge posse organized, insisting that the mayor run him out of town. He couldn't even sleep at a regular hotel, couldn't eat in a restaurant in Sanford for fear he would be poisoned. And finally, they ran them out of town. Florida, you see, is a former slave state, and it takes that notion very seriously. The mentality remains deeply entrenched in Florida. And it's significant, as a matter of fact, that the court is located in Seminole County. Seminole actually was not the name associated with any particular nation as such. Seminole was the word that the first people used to describe runaways. And they would take them in, which is why so many African American slaves, so many slaves fleeing from other states came to Florida, where the first peoples took them in. There's a long history of that. But tomorrow we will see all around the nation, in 100 cities, according to the Reverend Alfred Sharpton, who says that they're organizing the 100 cities for Trayvon Martin. And the goal of it is to encourage the Department of Justice to take action against Zimmerman on civil rights violation grounds. And here again, we are absolute, it's in our face, they're telling you, you didn't get your rights. Your rights did not exist in state court, which is another way of saying states' rights won. Your rights did not prevail in state court. And the only way that the federal government could help you is to take action with respect to your civil rights. The civil rights were just grudgingly given up from time to time because black folks bled and died and were murdered and lynched in the name of humanitarian recognition and in the name of human rights in the United States. So the rights that African Americans have, and they think that they are, how should I say, permanent rights. African Americans are fooled into believing that these are the same rights that accrue to all people, all citizens of the United States. Well, you're nuts. That's not the case. They're called civil rights for a reason. It is to differentiate the fact that you do not have natural rights. And it appears it's even lost on Reverend Sharpton. This is the whole point. Had the federal system really believed in the rights of African Americans as being equal with that of whites or anybody else, There's no way this case would have gone to trial. There's no way that this police department in Sanford or the prosecutor's office in Sanford would have been able to do a thing about litigating this case. They would probably right now be preparing to go to trial themselves as defendants for conspiring to derail justice here. But the Justice Department does not have that kind of guts. It is not allowed generally that the civil rights of an African American should take precedence over what the state says your rights are. And Florida's state's rights, Florida's state version of your rights, comes right out of the Dred Scott decision. The black man, in fact, he says, the black race has no business expecting to have the same rights as anybody else, because black folks are not real people. Only real people have rights. Zimmerman's actions were the actions he would have been, or he could have been, he might as well have been a white person, because that's how the state saw him. That's how the state gave him all that elastic, gave him all those exemptions and all those exceptions, made all those accommodations, because he symbolized the white standard with respect to blacks. Blacks are viewed as a kind of bacteria. And the whole fight is to contain the bacteria so that they don't spread out and contaminate anything. You have to contain them. You contain them psychologically now, because it has been amply demonstrated that now you're not even free to walk the streets. That too came right out of the slave codes. You have to have a pass to explain your presence on the street at a certain time of night, or even at a certain time of day, as we see in New York City with a stop and frisk. You have no rights, not even the right to life itself. All rights, and this is one thing African Americans have to understand, all rights are negotiable. You have no rights that are unassailable. All of your rights are perfectly alienable. You have no inalienable rights. Your rights, such as they are, have just been concessions, constitutional concessions. And that is to say, you have very limited rights as an African American. The state is a standard, the state prevails. Now, Zimmerman could have been a black man, blacker than blue. He still would have gotten that status because he upheld the standard. And the standard is that this notion of white supremacy must prevail at all costs. That's the standard. And why? Because that's the way it has been. All these years, in fact, centuries of people who are themselves oppressed, making an extra effort to accommodate the inhumanity, to say, if we love you hard enough, chances are you might see the error of your ways and you will change. That's not going to happen. The ruling simply translated was by the jury, we recognize as whites that Mr. Zimmerman was functioning just the way our husbands would and our sons would. He was a white man in that instance, in that minute where his path crossed that of Trayvon Martin. Zimmerman, for all intents and purposes, was representing, he was a stand-in for whiteness. Do you know any place where people would assume to have the authority to decide whether you should be on the street or not on the street? Or that you're wearing something that makes them uncomfortable? And your job is to see to it that I, the person with the power, I am to be comfortable, psychologically comfortable. And if I'm not, it is because there's something wrong with you. You are making me uncomfortable. And your job is to see to it that I am comfortable with you. So when this the appeal goes to the federal government, it is in fact endorsing the view that the maximum that any African American person could really expect from the criminal justice system is a nod towards civil rights. And that becomes an academic exercise. There's no question about your natural rights if you have them. But you can argue as the day is long about civil rights because there's so many conditions attached to it. There's so many ifs and ands and buts. It's not definitive. It's murky. All kinds of conditions are set to satisfy the protection that you have. And people cling to civil rights as if it's a great thing. No, you don't have. It's not a great thing. It's a concession. Understand that. If you understand your civil rights are a concession, no guarantees here, everything conditional, you may enjoy them if you meet certain conditions. Here's a man with a gun who didn't have to prove any condition, any kind of reason for having a gun. He had one, and he got it back after he used it to kill another human being. The other human being, however, was an African-American young man. So keep in mind, as this moves toward the grand discussion about civil rights violations and prosecution for civil rights, understand that it is hollow. There's no substance to that. Because in the first instance, you have to be dead. In order for Trayvon Martin to qualify for civil rights protection, he first had to be dead. That's a condition. Now, that's the bottom line. And we're joking if we build up in our heads all these, you know, sugar plums, about the legalistic sugar plums. Oh, the State Department is going to do this, and the Department of Justice is going to do this and do that. I told you what happened in the Amadou Diallo case. I was in the room, the only reporter allowed in the room. And if in a case where a person was shot at by four police officers for no reason, 41 times, 19 bullet wounds in his body, could not get justice, I don't know where the expectation is that there's going to be some degree of justice here. But even if there is, it would have occurred without systemic change. And the real crime is not the deprivation of Trayvon Martin's civil rights. We are clear that that was established. The real problem is the system of justice in Sanford still remains unchanged. And that's what I'm talking about. There was a conspiracy to derail this case. There was a conspiracy to show him preferential treatment. I'm talking about Zimmerman. There was somebody who made a decision that he did not have to stand up against any major prosecution. And these things were discussed, and these decisions were made. Who made them? Why? How? When? That's what the Justice Department ought to be doing. So, just keep that in mind. George Zimmerman, for all intents and purposes here, is a stand-in for the white standard, the standard of white supremacy. They agreed with that. Everybody in the courtroom understood that. And they understood that from the word go. As I said, you looked at the environment of the trial and it told you all that you needed to know. These are white people sitting down among other white people. And yes, they have a kind of legalistic quarrel going on. And this, they made this point and the other one countered that point with his other point. But essentially, they all agreed that the major point for them being there is this standard. Everything is measured against the standard. Zimmerman was not a Latino in that courtroom. Zimmerman was a white man taking the action of a white man. And that is why everybody had to be on board with that. It had to prevail. Now, people could talk Paul and preach Saul, and they can recite chapter and verse about all kinds of things, but it is not changing my mind. That is exactly how I see the situation. We are smack dab in the middle of the Dred Scott decision. And if you have done no other reading so far this year, you find it necessary to go look it up, read the Dred Scott decision, and you would understand what informed this entire scenario. From the personal decisions that George Zimmerman made to the legal decision the courts had made and the prosecutor had made, and finally the jury. And still, blacks are hoping. They're holding on to hope. We are going to love the enemy harder than ever just to make him see the error of his ways. And we're still not getting the point that there is no error in their ways as they see it. They organized it that way. They wrote it that way. They made it that way. There are no errors. A group of very high-minded and very bright-eyed and bushy-tailed young people, absolutely disgusted with the jury's decision, decided that they were going to confront Governor Scott, Rick Scott, and ask him to hold a special session in the state legislature to discuss the Stand Your Ground law. They thought that they would fold their tents and go away, but they stuck out. They called themselves, I think, the defenders of the dream. But they stuck it out. And finally, last evening, Governor Scott decided that he was going to meet with them. And he told them, no, there will be no meeting to discuss the Stand Your Ground law. There's no reason for it. It is perfectly fine just the way it is. Again, two entirely different conversations being had. These young people thought that they were involved in a civil rights action. The governor is very clear. He's there to affirm the natural rights of whites in Florida. He understood that. They didn't get it just yet, but they'll understand by and by. We'll take this break and come back to your calls at 888-874-4888. They would do anything to materialize their temporary wish. Oh, yeah. But won't put them down flat. They eat the bread of sorrow. Listening to PRN.FM. The program is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and we're taking your calls at 888-874-4888. Michael, you're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you.
I don't know if I could speak very clearly about this, but I have some feelings I'd like to try to say. I think, you know, you're absolutely right with this, the difference between natural rights and civil rights. And I don't want to be, you know, insensitive. It's not that I don't know any black history or what happened and why blacks had to take the route of civil rights and pursuing civil rights over a long period of time. Because they had to survive. There was brutal ethnic cleansing going on, and you know they created a ghetto and they had to survive as a people, and that was probably very threatened after the war, the Civil War and everything. But the very fact that civil rights means that, you know, blacks didn't have rights, as you said, as Dred Scott makes clear. And they said, well, we're going to work something out. We're going to give something to you, and we'll have to work out something legally, you know, civilly. But you don't have any rights that are self-evident like we do, you know, like mm-hmm. whites do. Your rights have to be worked out and hammered out legally, you know, and we got to create some boilerplate, you know, things. And like you say, you know, when the civil rights come up against, you know, natural rights, you know, the natural rights went out. And that's because there are no self-evident rights, no natural rights. These are legal stopgaps that were put in. These are legal, like, little bridges and Band-Aids and things to, you know, against some discrimination, you know, just things that were... that we're going to wipe us, you know, a group out completely. We're trying to say that. But in a sense, now this could be, you know, this could be seem like it's insensitive, but I don't think blacks should have pursued civil rights. I think they should have held out for natural rights, because civil rights means that you don't have regular rights. And I mean, it seems ridiculous. I mean, after all the black history. I'm not being ignorant completely of black history and everything that the race has been through, but just as a kind of ignorant person looking at it, I think that Malcolm X was talking about something different. I think he saw that, and I'm not really, so conversant about him. I didn't even read his autobiography, but I know a little bit. I think he was seeing the fact that civil rights is not really the rights that, they're not any rights. They're just legal band-aids. And so they're probably worse off for pursuing that instead of just holding out for that we have the rights as human beings.
Well, you don't forget the struggle for civil rights, people think started in the 60s. People really think that. The civil rights movement was in the 60s. The civil rights movement began the day they got here. In fact, the very first formal civil rights act was in the 1860s, 1866 it would be, and the struggle was being waged more than a century before that. So it's a case, like you just said, it's a case of something is better than nothing. But I'm saying, I discussed the civil rights issue to bring to the attention of listeners that when we look at a Zimmerman case, and some of the major cases that have popped up, the consistent pattern is, and it's never really expressed, that it is usually as a concession. The federal government is involved as a kind of a symbolic gesture, really, because everybody understands it. People who are in the courts, they all understand that the game is over. The real game is over. There will be no major punishment of Zimmerman, for example. Not only that, he goes back to enjoying the privileges of, having a gun.
He might even keep his gun.
That's right. He goes back to having his rights, his natural rights restored. And that is what we need to begin to understand, because there is a tendency to really believe that there has been so much progress. But we don't understand that institutions are designed to resist change, not to embrace it, but to resist it. And this is an example of how it did it.
Good point.
Well, thank you, Michael, for calling. Thank you so much for your contribution today.
Thank you.
Thank you. Willie, you're on the air.
Good afternoon, my dear sister.
Hey, how are you?
Beautiful program.
Thank you.
I'm always learning from you.
Thank you, William.
Listen, isn't Zimmerman himself a probationary white? Is he not?
Well, he was white by proxy in this entire situation, in the entire scenario. He was
I'm talking about originally.
Well, I don't know.
Then there's a certain group of Europeans who were not considered white.
Well, he describes himself. Well, I've seen various descriptions, actually.
Uh-huh.
He at one point is described as a Hispanic white, or he describes himself, I see, as white. And in the later part toward the trial, at the time of the trial, he described himself as Hispanic.
Oh, wait a second. Is he not a part of the Jewish community?
No.
No, he's not.
No.
Oh, okay.
His stepfather is Robert Zimmerman, but that's his stepfather, not his biological father.
Oh, okay. Well, I'd like to say, and I think, I don't know, maybe you could clarify me on that. I think that law, the standard, it's an excellent law. And the reason why I say this is very simple. If you have a law that states that you have the right to stand your ground, right, if you feel threatened, well, then the brothers, particularly in New York, that would be a great law in New York, because all the brothers have to do is get their guns, and whenever they feel threatened by anybody, just shoot them.
Well, again, that I mean, I understand you saying this, of course, with a degree of sarcasm.
No, I'm very serious. Wait. I'm very serious.
By that I mean, I understand where you're coming from on that. Here's the thing. Even if they did it, they still will not be seen as having the right to do it. Even if the law says so.
Okay, that's fine. However,
the law said in the situation with Trayvon, okay, yes, the same law that applied to George Zimmerman theoretically applied to Trayvon Martin. But did you see, I mean, everybody was arguing the man did not have, Trayvon Martin did not have the right.
Well, I understand all of that. To take
advantage of the law.
But however, if Trayvon had a gun, this story would be a very, very different story. That's what I'm saying.
It would be different.
If you have the right to carry a gun, carry one, and whenever you feel threatened, just shoot whoever you're threatened by. Simple.
Well, I'll tell you, if that happened, and I think you know, if Trayvon Martin had a gun, and in this instance, he shot Zimmerman and killed Zimmerman, this guy would be under the jail so fast, and this would be a capital offense, and there would be a grand jury impaneled, because the whole point would be to put the death penalty on the books, right for that crime.
No, wait a second. But in that case, he would have the right to stand your ground. You see what I'm saying?
Look,
that's what the law says. And the story, even if they railroaded him and he went to jail, all right, he would still be alive. We're the only one taking our people to the cemetery. I have a problem with that. Hello?
I'm listening to you.
When we could make all kinds of arguments. For example, we have the tape of this guy, the police telling him, "Lord, please don't do that." Next thing we know, and all of that, I'm not interested in that story. I'm saying if he had a gun, this story would be very, very different, and at least he would be alive, even if you're in jail, because the objective is to stay alive as long as you possibly can, because when death is final, and we're the one that's always going to the cemetery.
Well, thanks for offering your opinion. I'm sure people will be reacting to it. Thank you, Willie. Thanks so much for calling. Hello, you're on the air, Jay. Hello? Somebody's there? Is Jay there?
Yeah. Oh, excuse me, Eutrice. I didn't hear you. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Oh, okay. Sorry about that. In regards to the verdict in the Zimmerman case, you know, it's really not surprising that it turned out the way that it did. I think, from my observation, based on what Dura N37 said, that at the beginning of the deliberations, there was 3 to convict and 3 not to convict. And I truly believe that juror number N37 was the juror that changed the other juror's mind to go with non-guilty. I listened to a statement that Benjamin Crump had made when he said, I think it was yesterday on Sharpton show, that he prepares the jury in the cases that he do to hold out if they believe that a person is not guilty, to be dissuaded from sticking to their guns. He says that he uses that at the beginning of a trial. And based on the trial, from what I've seen, I honestly and truly believe that there was a fix in it from the beginning. I don't think that the prosecution presented the type of case necessary to get a conviction on a murder too. And I truly believe that the charge should have been manslaughter. Now, the thing that I'm most concerned about now is, where do we go from here? they're talking about going to all of these cities and having these rallies and all of these type of events. But the bottom line from what I have seen through history is these things die down after a certain period of time. The towns that they go into basically to protest just get a little more richer, if the truth be told. And those that are at the front are able to push forward their agenda in regards to shaping and defining the argument to keep them in their tick position. So, you know, we as a community have to figure out a way to make it so that when events like this happen, we could at some point in time change the paradigm on how it's being discussed and how we move forward. Because I'm going to let it be known, I cannot support and follow Al Sharpton, Jesse Jackson, and none of them anywhere at this point in time in my life. You know what I mean? So, I feel for Trayvon Martin's family, but I'm pretty sure that the fix within, that there's never going to be any justice whatsoever in regards to this matter. And I guess later on you'll hear the statement that the president just came out with in the brief conference, like maybe 10, 15 minutes ago. So once you hear it, I know you'll do a critical analysis next week on it. But it's all a game, and it's sad because the American people are the ones who are suffering, and we're suffering the worst.
Well, thank you for your call, Jay. I think, though, that this particular incident has really struck a chord because people can't believe that in the scenario that they came to understand and appreciate, as many facts as they possibly could, that this case did not result in any prosecution, really, of the confessed killer. I think that troubled people deeply across the board. Yes, I understand that, there are issues with Sharpton and Jackson and so forth, but some people would say, well, at least they're doing something. At least they're trying to do something. I understand your observation because I believed for far too long, a lot of these folks, they kind of like these scenarios because it gets them under the warm glow of the television cameras for a hot minute. And it affords them the ability to, kind of reaffirm their stature, even if it's faded. But I understand all of that. But the practical matter is they need to drive home a point that the Trayvon Martin's family is not alone in the struggle. And in a way, this is every person's struggle, not just black people either. This is a struggle for all fair-minded and conscious and conscientious people who want to see a system become fair and who want to see that justice is done. I think there are many, many people who are very upset about it. So I understand and appreciate your point. I certainly do. But that's the dilemma we always find ourselves in tragic times like these. You know, it's almost like you're caught between the devil and the deep blue sea. You know, you want to do something, and then you look at the leadership and you go, oh, Lord, have mercy. You know, what is this? You know, I understand it very well. I've observed that for a long time. Well, our program is running out of time today, and I hope it gives you some thought, some pause for thought. And what I'd like you to do when you get a chance is to read that decision, because it is truly a landmark decision that has framed life, everyday life in America, for everybody, but especially African Americans. This particular piece of legislation, it is the standing attitude in the courts It is the standing attitude in society. It is, in fact, a reaffirmation of white supremacy. That's really what this is, and that's what we've been discussing. And all fair-minded people should be aware that nobody profits, nobody really comes through this process unscathed when you hold to false standards. And we have to speak out when we see an injustice, and there's no question that there is an injustice here. There's no question about it. So with these remarks, I wish you a very good weekend. Take it easy, but do some reading if you can. Every day so, go back and read a paragraph or two about this Dred Scott case, and you would understand what it is we're talking about here, about entrenched, institutionalized thinking. This is where it comes from. So I want to thank you very much, Michael, Willie, and Jay. Thank you for your very thoughtful contributions to the program today. And I want you to stay tuned, because coming up next is Richard Martin with Wake Up Call. We'll see each other again on Monday. Thanks so much for being here. Bye-bye.